I thought it was an unfair remark and caught up to Kofi on the runway.
You have to go back on the plane and challenge him to a fight right now. If you don't, he'll know he can walk all over you whenever he wants. If you go challenge him, he'll love it and respect you for it.
I wasn't ribbing Kofi. I legitimately meant what I said and wanted to see him stand up for himself. To his credit, he only thought about it for a few seconds before marching back up the steps of the jet. I followed closely behind.
"How's your dad?" Vince asked me as I got to the top of the stairs. "Tell him to give me a call. I really like that guy and would love to chat with him again."
They'd met once.
Kofi piped up and said with some big boy bass in his voice,
"Vince, do you have a problem with me?"
Vince looked him in surprise as Kofi repeated the question.
"Maybe I do," Vince replied. "Do you want to do something about it?"
Kofi swallowed hard, knowing he'd gone too far to turn back now.
"Do you want me to do something about it?"
"Do you want to do something about it?"
Vince repeated as he looked seriously into Kofi's eyes from his chair.
"Do you want me to do something about it?"
"Do you want to do something?"
Vince double-legged Kofi mid-sentence. They scuffled and rolled around in the aisle for a few seconds until Vince got up laughing.
"That's the way to do it,"
he belly-laughed and got off the plane. Kofi looked at me for justification, and I gave him a big thumbs-up. I'm not sure if he gained Vince's respect that night, but he sure gained mine. We got taken to a beautiful hotel in Glendale. When I checked into my room, it was almost 5 a.m. We had to be downstairs in the lobby by 8:30 a.m., so there wasn't much time to sleep. However, I had no intention of going to bed because I was staring at a lamp on the desk and it was bugging me. The lamp stared back at me pompously, and I decided I didn't like its attitude. I karate chopped it to the floor along with its goofy twin brother and smiled as they broke into pieces. Then I glanced at the large painting of a mixed bouquet hanging on the wall beside the bed and decided I didn't like the way it was mean-mugging me either. I grabbed it underneath its frame and ripped it off the wall, losing my grip in the process. It smashed onto the floor and shards of glass splintered across the entire room. Satisfied with my handiwork, I lay down and promptly passed out. I woke up a few hours later, wondering when an evil invader had trashed my room. The place was a mess, with broken glass and garbage all over the floor, bath towels flung askew amidst the twisted remains of the dearly departed lamp twins. I only had a few minutes to get ready for the press conference, and even though my head was pounding and I felt bad about breaking the promise I'd made to myself after the HBK situation, I had to clean up my room first. I tried in vain to MacGruber the lamps back together, cleaned the glass up off the floor, and piled the big shards on top of the flat picture frame. I picked it up like a giant junkyard pizza and slowly walked to the door, figuring if I hit the picture in the staircase, nobody would notice it was missing. The giant rectangular outline on the wall wouldn't make it too obvious. I nudged the door open with my foot and barged in the hallway, running right into a maintenance man who asked what happened.
The picture must have been put on the wall wrong, 'cause it fell off in the middle of the night.
Scared the shit out of me, too. The guy took the painting out of my hands, saying,
"Don't worry, Mr. Jericho. I'll take care of it for you. Not a big deal."
He gave me a knowing wink and disappeared into the stairwell. The guy had a long braided beard and looked like a rocker, the type of guy I could see myself having a few cocktails with whilst we talked about metal. The type of guy that would have my back and help me get away with smashing a giant picture. If there's one thing I've learned, it's that you can always trust a bearded rocker. And I knew we were going to stick it to the man together in the name of rock and roll. I went back into my room, put on my suit, and got ready to razzle-dazzle the fine people of Arizona. A week later, I was called into Johnny's office, and he was sitting in front of a stack of papers.
"What happened to your room in Phoenix?"
he asked and showed me photocopies of my trashed room. The lamps, the broken glass, the disengaged towel rack, and the smashed picture were all represented. A rat bastard bearded rocker had double-crossed me. I admitted to Johnny that I'd drunk too much on the plane and took it out on my room. He said he understood and then presented me with a bill for $1,700, the cost of the damage I'd caused. Destroying a hotel room was fun, but really expensive.
Next time I'll leave the room trashing to the Keith Moons of the world and stick with stealing a couple extra bars of soap. Now that all the promotion was finished, WrestleMania 26 had arrived, and it was time to make the donuts. Edge and I were the seventh match on the show, and I think it turned out pretty good, but not great. We put together an exciting match filled with a multitude of flashy reversals and counters to take the fans on a real roller coaster ride, and it worked to an extent. My problem with the match is the same one I have with a lot of my stadium matches. It's hard to gauge the reactions of the audience when you're in a venue of that size. The crowd noise tends to travel up and out of the open roof instead of hitting you full force in the center of the ring, so I couldn't tell for sure if the spots were working. But the finish, where I hit Edge with the title belt and followed up with a codebreaker for the win, was damn good. I was a little surprised when Vince told me I was going over, as I thought the idea was to build Edge into the face of SmackDown. That was still the overall plan, but Vince felt the fans would get behind him more if he had to chase the title longer. The match finish worked like a charm, but paled in comparison to the real finish, where Edge got his revenge, and his WrestleMania moment, by spearing me off the announce table through the guardrail on the floor. This was a Michael Hayes idea, and it sounded better in theory than it did in reality. Hayes had a habit of suggesting high spots that sounded completely insane, things he never would have done during his slammin' and jammin' Freebird career. But if I could figure out a way to take the bump without cracking my head open, I was all for it. We met up the night before Mania to discuss the stunt with our prop guys. They decided the best way to do it would be to construct a breakaway guardrail wall with a 3-inch rubber pad on the floor behind it to cushion my fall. The only thing I had to worry about was making it to that pad from the desk, which was easier said than done since I couldn't see where I was landing. After I pinned Edge, I dragged him over to the announce desk, but before I could finish him off, I'm not sure exactly what I was planning to do, he turned the tide and slammed me on the table. Then he hurried to the other side of the Spanish announce mesa, which was next to the one I was on, and led the jam-packed stadium in a spear chant as I slowly got to my feet. I stood up fully as he galloped across the first desk, leapt over to the second, and drove his shoulder into my stomach. We flew through the air, and I put my hand behind my head at the last second to protect myself as we crashed through the guardrail. Any reservations I had about the crowd not being into our match dissipated when we hit the barrier, because they lost their shit at that point. It was over before it even started, and I didn't feel a thing. As a matter of fact, my first thought when I landed was, that was fun. I want to do that again. Edge stood tall and unleashed a war cry as 65,000 fans joined him. I think I was one of them. 2 days later at SmackDown in Las Vegas, Vince called me into his office with Jack Swagger. Swagger was a hot new prospect who'd come up the amateur wrestling ranks and was enjoying his first big push in the WWE. In a dramatic turn of events, Vince had decided once again to not give Edge the title, but put it on Swagger instead. I'm not sure exactly why, but it didn't matter because Vince had made up his mind. Since Swagger had won the Money in the Bank match at Mania, he was going to cash the briefcase in against me that night after Edge speared me. Swagger was nervous as Vince told him the plan and asked him if he was ready for the challenge. Jack said all the right things, and Vince nodded with approval, then wanted to know if I had anything else to add. I thought of my Japanese upbringing, the way respect was taught to me, and decided to give Swags a little tough love. Are you ready for this, Swagger? Because this is a big deal. And if you fuck this up, it's going to make me look bad, and that is unacceptable. If I feel you are getting a big ahead or demeaning this title in any way, I'm going to come after you. Do you understand? Swagger nodded, wide-eyed, and promised he wouldn't let me down. He left the office, and Vince asked, "That was a little stiff, wasn't it?" I didn't think so. Swagger was having a lot thrown on his shoulders that day, and I didn't want to sugarcoat it for him. Being the champion was a huge responsibility, and I wanted to strike a little fear into his heart to help prepare him for what was about to come. Later that night, Edge speared me into oblivion, which was Swagger's cue to cash in the briefcase, which allowed him a title shot whenever he chose, and challenged me for the title. He gave the case to the ref, who quickly rang the bell, and Swagger dragged me up for his finish, When he stuck my head between his legs to give me his gut-wrench power bomb, it reminded me of an idea I'd had years earlier in WCW but never got to do. I'd wanted Goldberg to literally spear me out of my shoes at the end of a PPV match, but since we never had the match, I thought it would be fun to do the same thing with Swags. I had a few seconds as he played to the crowd, so I loosened my heel inside my dress shoe. Then, as he pulled me up onto his shoulders, I kicked it off and shot it straight into the fans. If you were in Las Vegas that night and caught my size 11 Hugo Boss, you possessed the rarest of all Jericho merchandise. And now that the secret is out, I predict it will be more sought after than the Y2J bowling ball. Chapter 35. That's Why I Listen. I got a call from Johnny that Lorne Michaels was producing a movie for the Saturday Night Live character MacGruber and wanted a group of WWE superstars to appear in the film. Mark Henry, MVP, Big Show, Kane, and Great Khali had already agreed to do it, and they wanted me as well. Anytime I've done projects outside the WWE, I've always tried to stay away from cliched wrestling parts, so I was wary of agreeing right away. If all they wanted me to do was to have a wrestling match in the background of a scene or whatever, I wasn't interested. So in typical Jericho fashion, before agreeing to be in a major motion picture, I asked to see the script first. They sent it to me, and not only was it really funny, but I was the only WWE guy who had any lines in the film. I was happy to see that my character also had a name. I had no interest in being Lunkhead number two, and a one-on-one scene with MacGruber himself, played by Will Forte. I was Frank Corver, the leader of a group of mercenaries that MacGruber assembles to eliminate the evil dieter Von Kunth, and then accidentally blows up. The MacGruber character is a parody of MacGyver, and is a bumbling doofus who constantly tries to disarm weapons, but in the end just blows himself and his friends up. This was the first movie based on an SNL skit in years, so Lorne and his crew had high hopes for it. So did I, as it was my first big-budget movie and I wanted to make a good impression. I flew into Albuquerque, New Mexico, a day early to hang around the set and meet all of my co-workers, like Spiwi had for Boots, including director Jorma Taccone, who told me to shave the mustache I'd grown for the part because it was too gay. Producer Seth Myers, who was wearing a Coneheads baseball cap and told me if I had any funny ideas to give them a try, and stars Will Forte and Kristen Wiig, former groundlings who were impressed that I'd also spent a year with the legendary improv troupe. As is usually the case when fellow improvers meet for the first time, we engaged in a bunch of unfunny comedy bits and laughed like we were Robin Williams in 1978. But lucky for me, my second attempt at engaging Forte in improv the next day was much more successful. We were filming my big one-on-one scene with MacGruber in a sweaty little boxing gym on the outskirts of town, and it was stifling hot inside. The scene started with Groobs interrupting Corver's workout after finally tracking me down. We would banter for a few seconds until he asked me to rejoin his team, and that would be the end of it. Pretty simple, really, but once again in typical Jericho fashion, I decided my two lines weren't enough and wanted more. With Will's groundlings training, I figured if I shot an extra line over to him, there was a good chance he'd pick it up. Plus, Seth had already encouraged me to be creative, so I figured nobody would get mad if I threw something extra against the sweaty gym wall. The worst thing that could happen was they would cut and tell me to stick to the script, right? We ran through the scene a few times as it was written, while the lighting and sound guy set everything up and waited until everyone was ready to go. If I was going to take the chance to throw out some extra lines, I wanted to wait until the cameras were rolling and everybody was listening to what I was saying. Jorma yelled, "Action!" and I started bench-pressing until MacGruber called my name. I racked the weights in surprise, shocked that he was still alive. "MacGruber? The last time I saw you, you had just ripped a dude's throat out with your bare hands." "Classic, MacGruber. Looks like you're keeping your bod pretty tight. And you're looking pretty good yourself." "Well, every day is a workout when you have to carry around a 20-pound python in your jeans." Now I was supposed to tell him we'd had some good times together, and that would be the end of my dialogue. While I felt fortunate to have been asked to be in the movie, my two lines were merely setups for MacGruber's jokes, and I didn't want to be the only guy in a comedy who didn't get any laughs. So
So I thought I'd take a chance, and instead of reciting my scripted line, I said, "You and your dick comments." I didn't know if Will would take the bait and run with it or have a tantrum and kick me off the set. To my pleasant surprise, he ran with it.
"It's fun to say them."
Okay, not bad. Kind of funny. Now, like in a tennis match, it was my turn to volley something back at him quickly. "It's fun to hear them." Will was into it, and with perfect timing replied, "That's why I say them." The sign of a good improv scene is when it takes on a life of its own, and this one just had. But I needed a tagline, and a millisecond later, I found it. And that's why I listen. There was a brief pause after Jorma yelled, "Cut!" And everyone on set burst out laughing, including Forte, Wig, the funniest woman in America, and more important, Lorne Michaels, who'd snuck in when I wasn't watching. I'm glad I didn't see him, because I don't know if I would have had the balls to go off script if I knew he was watching. But my ad-libs were a hit, and Jorma wanted to shoot the scene a few more times with my additional dialogue included. After a couple additional takes, we wrapped and I walked outside to get some fresh air. I was surprised to see Lauren, who was sitting in a canvas folding chair in the middle of Video Village.
"Chris, I want to tell you that you were very funny. Thank you for your input."
While it was awesome to get a compliment like that from one of the greatest comedy minds of all time, there was something more distracting that was diverting my attention. I couldn't get over how much Lauren sounded like Dr. Evil. I'd always heard the rumors that Mike Myers had based his Austin Powers Dr. Evil character on Lorne Michaels, and after hearing him talk in person, there was no doubt in my mind that he had. His voice and mannerisms were exactly the same. All he needed was a bald cap and Vern Troyer by his side. It was hard not to laugh as I chatted with Lauren about comedy and Canada. Then I started noticing the similarities between him and another visionary I knew, Vince McMahon. Think about it. Both created worldwide empires by taking a chance and doing something revolutionary. Both were told their respective brainchild would never work and that they were crazy to even try. And both had created iconic entertainment juggernauts whose success rode on the shoulders of the individual performers who starred on the shows throughout the years. Both men had to constantly regroup and create new stars when flagship names left their companies, whether it was Chevy Chase, Eddie Murphy, Adam Sandler, and Will Ferrell on SNL, or Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart, Steve Austin, and The Rock in the WWE. They both could make or break careers on a whim, as both decided who got the most airtime on their respective shows and determined who would get the chance to be the breakout stars or who would fade away, no matter how talented. Don't believe me? Check out Julia Louis-Dreyfus or Chris Rock's success on SNL, or Bobby Roode and Barry Windham's in the WWE. Plus, Vince and Lorne were both quirky, powerful, intimidating bosses whose distinct voices were often imitated by their employees. I finished my conversation with Lorne, went back inside the gym, and beelined it over to Will.
"Dude, I just spoke to Lorne, and I can't believe how much he sounds like Dr. Evil. It was so exact that I was expecting him to raise his pinky to his mouth and..."
Forte waved his hand in front of his throat in a slashing motion. My smile disappeared, and I turned around slowly, certain that Lorne was standing behind me. He wasn't, but now Will was pointing desperately at my lav, the little mic clipped to the neckline of my tank top. "Turn that off," Will was mouthing to me frantically. I reached around to the pack on my belt and pulled the cord.
"Take the batteries out."
Concerned now, I took the back off the pack and shook them out into the palm of my hand.
"You can't say that."
"Say what?" I replied like Richard Pryor.
"You can never say that Lauren sounds like Dr. Evil. He hates it."
"But he does sound like Dr. Evil."
"Of course he does, but he doesn't think he does and hates it when people say so. If he hears you say anything about it, he'll probably fire you on the spot. So don't ever mention it again."
I thanked him for the heads up, but what if Lauren had been listening to me in Video Village and was now waiting to fire me on the spot?
"Chris!"
I turned to see Lauren walking toward me. This was it. I was going to be embarrassed in front of the entire cast and kicked off the set. I was never going to work in comedy again.
"Just wanted to say great work again today, Chris. See you tomorrow,"
Lauren said with a tight-lipped smile.
He shook my hand and I stifled a giggle, thinking about the Alan Parsons Project. I was on set the next morning at 5:30 a.m., shivering in an unheated trailer as the pre-dawn drizzle danced off the cold tin roof. Even though we were in New Mexico in May, it was freezing outside, and I couldn't wait to start filming to get some movement going. The day's scene consisted of MacGruber's mercenaries getting blown up after he inadvertently sets off a bomb in their van. It was an intricate shot that was going to take some time to get right, hence the early call time. Kane, MVP, Mark Henry, and I were all on time and accounted for, but nobody could find the great collie. After trying to track him down for hours, he finally answered his phone at 9 a.m. While the rest of us had been up and ready at 5 a.m., Collie thought the pickup was for 5 p.m. and had spent the night 90 miles away in Santa Fe with some of his minions. Collie was such a massive star in his native India that he would be chauffeured around and wined and dined by his fellow Punjabis in almost every city in America. But while he was in Santa Fe acting like a big shot, the rest of the cast and crew were on set in Albuquerque waiting for him. Nobody seemed too upset about the delay, but I was. I felt he was giving the WWE a bad rap and fucking me over personally, because if anybody found out the delay was due to the wrestlers not being ready, that would make us all look like shit. By the time he finally arrived on set a little after 11 a.m. and loped into his trailer without a word of apology to anybody, I was furious. I was cold, tired, and pissed off at his nonchalant attitude, so I threw open the door of his trailer and got right in his face. "What the hell, man?" I said, looking him straight in the eye, which was only possible because he was sitting down. "You made us late for the scene because you were too lazy to get up on time, and everybody has been waiting on you. You made us all look bad, and if you ever do anything like this again, I will punch you right in your stupid giant face. Do you understand?" Collie glanced at me, the smirk never leaving his face, and said, "No problem, bro." I stormed out of the trailer and bumped right into Val Kilmer, literally. He was wearing black Crocs and a full set of green medical scrubs, even though he wasn't playing a doctor in the movie. Those were just his regular clothes. He glared at me and made a noise like the governor in Blazing Saddles. He growled as he brushed past me. With all the adrenaline running through me after stupidly challenging Collie to a fistfight, he's lucky I didn't make him my huckleberry and knock him the fuck out. Even though MacGruber bombed at the box office, it became a cult classic due to constant cable repeats and a great word of mouth. It's a favorite bus movie of Avenged Sevenfold and Bumpershine, and John Mayer loves it so much he can recite the whole script verbatim. Seriously. I was at an SNL after-party when he approached me wearing a full Stormtrooper outfit. It was Halloween, and talking a bunch of gibberish. I'd never met him before and thought he was just really drunk, but after a few seconds I realized he was perfectly reciting my lines from MacGruber. "It's fun to hear them. That's why I say them. That's why I listen." Mayer finished up the scene, then gave me his critique of my performance, his favorite scene of the film, his review of the movie, an all-time modern comedic classic, and his theory of how MacGruber was actually social commentary on the state of the world today. Maybe it would have made more sense if he was just really drunk. MacGruber was enough of a hit that Will, Kristen, and Ryan Phillippe were asked to guest host Raw at the Izod Center in New Jersey. This was the show we flew in from Madrid for. I filmed a brilliant backstage bit with Will and Kristen where I claimed to be starring in the sequel, sang a new version of the MacGruber theme using my name instead, Jarico, and gave him advice for his match with Great Khali. I should have told him to punch him in his stupid giant face. Then I flirted with Kristen's character Vicky until she walked away singing my new theme song, Jarico. It was a real test to have to hold my own with two of the funniest people in America, and I was proud of how funny it turned out to be. After the show, Brian Gewirtz and I hung out with Kristen and her parents, who were big Y2J fans, and then went to meet with Forte and the rest of the SNL cast for dinner in Manhattan. It was like sitting in a WWE production meeting watching them discuss plans for that week's show, hosted by Inception's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. They debated what skits would work, which ones wouldn't, and which ones might get cut last minute by Lorne. The conversation was delicious, and my dinner even more so, especially when I noticed they had fresh-baked apple crisp on the menu.
Apple crisp was one of my mom's specialties, and even though nobody has ever made it as good as she did, it was rare to find it on a menu anywhere, and I was dying to try it. Brian and Will agreed that the dessert choices were amazing and were excited to try something as well. We waited an unusually long time for the waitress to come back, and I was practically drooling when she finally did. "Hi," I said cheerily. "I'd like to get the fresh-baked apple crisp for dessert, please. It sounds amazing."
"I'm sorry, sir, but your tab has been closed. Joseph Gordon-Levitt paid for everybody," she said with a smile.
"What? That son of a bitch Levitt paid the whole tab without first asking if anybody wanted anything else? Who does that? I mean, the nerve of that solipsistic blowhard. He had committed the most heinous of all culinary crimes. Joseph Gordon-Levitt was a dessert denier." To make up for the horrible reality that we wouldn't be having any dessert, we started drinking heavily and were pretty loaded when we left to meet Philippi at a club. Forte and Jason Sudeikis were quite impressed that I was one half of the double tag team champions, along with Sho, and insisted on walking through Times Square while wearing the titles. Thankfully, we didn't get mugged, as I would have had a hard time explaining the missing belts to Vince. He probably would have made an angle out of it. We turned into a dark alleyway that was supposed to lead to the club, but only found a cluster of small Chinese shops instead. Then Will knocked on one of the unmarked doors, and I wasn't sure if I was about to buy a drink or a gremlin. A blob of a man opened the door, and after exchanging a few words with Forte, led us through a kitchen and up a flight of stairs into one of the most happening clubs I've ever been in. Scantily clad knockouts were gyrating on the packed dance floor bathed in laser lights as house music pounded through the massive speakers at full volume. The walls must have been lined with titanium to keep the place soundproof, for I hadn't heard a single note in the alleyway below. We went over to the VIP section where Ryan was hanging with his posse. He'd just been divorced from Reese Witherspoon, and the small sectioned-off area was boob to boob with girls of all shapes and sizes. In the few interactions we had, Ryan was really fruit to me and greeted me with open arms. After some small talk, of which I only heard every two words he said due to the pounding beat, he introduced me to a couple of guys standing beside us.
"This is Neo and Tio."
I shook hands and gave the fake Hollywood hug to both, but while Neo seemed nice enough, Tio just there stood, stone-faced. There wasn't a lot of room to move, so I thought I'd try to alleviate the awkwardness by striking up a conversation.
"So, do you guys have any shows coming up?"
I yelled in Tio's face over the music.
"Huh?"
he yelled back with a confused look. Wow, this music was loud.
"Do you guys have any shows coming up?"
I screamed into his ear.
"Nah, man, not really."
"Oh, are you working on a new album then?"
Tio looked at me like I was speaking bocce and shouldered his way to the other side of the VIP area. Brian came over and I told him how I'd just been blown off. That Tio guy's a real jerk. Brian asked me why, and I told him. Because when I asked him if he was going on tour or doing a new record, he just ignored me and walked away.
"Why would he be doing a new record?"
Brian asked quizzically.
"Duh, because he's a rapper."
"He's not a rapper, he's a football player. That's Tio."
The guy was Terrell Owens, the three-time NFL Pro Bowl wide receiver, not Tio, or more specifically T.I., the three-time Grammy winner I'd mistaken him for. It's official. I am the hashtag worst football and rap fan ever.
Chapter 36, Buddy Peacock.
Vince decided he wanted to put some of the younger talent languishing down in the developmental territory in Tampa on TV quick, so he devised the idea of pairing some of the new guys with established veterans in a pseudo-reality show called Next. If he was playing Wheel of Fortune, he would have needed to buy a vowel for Next, but he liked the cutting-edge fruit factor of spelling it wrong, NXT. He also liked the idea of having me involved as one of the vets. I balked at the idea as I didn't think the Chris Jericho character would care enough about anybody else to be their mentor. I also had no desire to increase my schedule, since I was already working four shows a week. Now, with the Next taping, I'd have to do five shows a week, not something that I saw in the cards. I talked it over with CM Punk, who'd also been asked to do the show,
and hated the whole idea as well. We decided we'd go to Vince separately so he wouldn't feel like we were ganging up on him. You never got what you wanted that way. And try to talk him out of selecting us. When I told Vince my concerns, he smiled and told me he wanted the show to be a hit and needed my star power. He also promised me I wouldn't have to work every Tuesday. I pretty much did anyway. I wouldn't have to do much on the show, which he was right about. Bottom line was, he pulled his Jedi mind trick again, and I left the office feeling happy about doing NWT instead of hating the whole concept. Not sure how he always did that, but he did. The following Tuesday, the 7 NWT rookies were at ringside, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, shaking hands and minding their manners. I'd been told my protege was one Wade Barrett, a name I didn't recognize. I kept waiting to hear the name as the guys introduced themselves to me one by one. Justin Gabriel, Darren Young, Heath Slater, most of whom I'd never met before. I had met Brian Danielson, who'd already made a name for himself worldwide with his amazing skills, but he had been told to think of another name for his WWE debut. His original idea was Buddy Peacock, but he went with Daniel Bryan instead, and I'd say that was the better choice. A tall, tough-looking Englishman named Stu introduced himself and shook my hand, but I was too preoccupied with finding Wade Barrett and kind of blew him off. I couldn't find him anywhere and was starting to get pissed off at the audacity of this guy making himself scarce on his first day of work. I asked Chris if he'd seen this Barrett character anywhere, and he pointed at Stu, which was Wade's real name. After being properly introduced, the two of us made a pretty good team for NWT. There were a few other interesting duos, including Punk and Darren Young, Matt Hardy and Justin Gabriel, Christian and Heath Slater, and Miz and Daniel Bryan, a hilarious concept that drove the smart fans crazy, as Bryan was already a highly respected veteran on the indie scene. But it was obvious to me Barrett was the ringer. We did a great job of feeding off each other on screen and developed a good chemistry fairly quickly. My role on the show was a mix of mentoring Wade and critiquing the other rookies with the pros. We'd sit on the stage watching them perform their various tasks, grading them on score sheets. The sheets were then collected and the scores tallied to see who won. But we soon found out that our opinions pretty much meant nothing, so after that, if anyone ever read our score sheets, they would have found tic-tac-toe games, lewd remarks, and drawings of my old friend Mr. Cockenballs. I also had to wrestle on Next once in a while, which I never wanted to do as I was in a bad mood from having to be there in the first place. Call time for TV days was usually 2 p.m., but I was getting there at 5 p.m. or later and didn't care. I couldn't be bothered getting there on time just to sit around all day doing nothing. On the days I did have to wrestle, it was a piece of piss to put together a short match against a guy with very little experience. I'd lay out the whole match, and nobody had any better ideas anyway, except maybe Daniel Bryan, who I thought was excellent from the moment he walked into the WWE. We wrestled each other on the very first Next show, and even though we only had 6 minutes, it turned out pretty damn good, highlighted by Bryan overshooting me on a dive outside of the ring and slamming into the announce table at full speed. The wipeout looked vicious, but because we were under a time constraint, I threw him right back inside and continued on like it didn't happen, instead of teasing a count-out or changing the finish altogether. It still bugs me that I made the rookie mistake of following along with the script instead of capitalizing on the moment, but I chalked it up as a lesson instead. Bryan was explosive in the ring and had such an ingratiating quality that the fans dug. I knew he would get over big, as he'd done it many times before in Ring of Honor and New Japan. It was the same principle that explained how guys like Eddie, Benoit, Ray, and I got to world champion status. Once you learned how to get over, you could do it anywhere, be it a dome in Tokyo, Japan, or a community center in Beckley, West Virginia. Daniel had already toured the world on his own and been successful at every level. But he went through the same trial by fire as I did and found out quickly that when you first come into the WWE, it doesn't matter what you've accomplished elsewhere. You have to prove yourself from scratch. And at first, it seemed that Vince didn't care for Daniel Bryan. Because he was a vegan. Ah,
What kind of a person doesn't eat steak? He once said to me in disgust.
So if you don't eat meat, you're obviously a jerk, right? That's why Brian's first gimmick in the WWE was being a heel vegan. Also, at first glance, Daniel didn't look like the typical WWE superstar. He wasn't very tall, had an average look, and dressed like a hippie librarian. But he could wrestle like a motherfucker and knew how to connect with the crowd, which is why he's a top star in the business today, with one of the most popular catchphrases in history. Who would have guessed 10 years ago that the two most used words by the WWE Universe in 2014 would be yes and what? If Daniel Bryan was the best member of the next rookie squad, then Heath Slater was, not the best. And I was shocked when I heard Vince wanted me to put him over in a nothing match. I furiously paced the empty arena floor, wondering why the hell I was supposed to lose to this rookie. I didn't want to be part of the stupid next as it was, and now I was supposed to put over a young boy in his first match in the company? I was mad as hell and wasn't going to take it anymore, and when I saw Vince, I was going to tell him so. But fate stepped in, and thankfully, I ran into Pat Patterson first.
Pat, you gotta help me. I'm so fucking pissed off right now. Vince wants me to put over Heath Slater.
Pat looked at me calmly.
So what's?
What do you mean, so what? I snapped back.
So what's? Who care? It's not like anybody's going to remember this match anyway. If you were a babyface, it might make a difference. But you're a heel, so go have fun with it.
As much as I didn't want to admit it, Pat was right. Stu Hart once told me that the biggest marks in the business were the boys themselves, and I was proving him right. I knew better than to care about wins and losses, and they usually didn't mean that much to me. Sure, if you're losing every night, you're not going to be around long. But if you have the ability to make the audience care about you and still win the big one from time to time, you'll always have a great spot in the WWE and stay over with the audience. Even though I knew that, my pride still got in the way sometimes. But as Marcellus Wallace once said, fuck pride. It was my pride that caused me to flip out about losing to Slater. But the bottom line was, it was my job to do what the boss wanted me to do, and to make it great. That's the nature of show business, not just in the WWE. I mean, if Steven Spielberg cast me in Indiana Jones 5, The Search for Abner Ravenwood, and my character was scripted to get shot in the ball bag in the first 10 minutes, I couldn't very well go complain and try to get it changed now, could I? If I did, he'd tell me to make like a tree and get out of there and cast my look-alike Jonah Hill in the part instead. I've always compared being in the WWE to being on a good hockey team. Some nights you get 30 minutes of ice time and are expected to score the big goals. Other nights you kill penalties or work the power play. And other nights you only play a few shifts a game. But if you don't play your designated role properly and to the best of your abilities, your team will lose. If you kick ass at your position, no matter how big or small of a role it may be, your team will win. I always wanted my WWE team to win, so that night I wrestled Heath Slater and put that dude over to the best of my abilities. He pinned me with a small package, much to the crowd's delight, and left the ring with a huge win, while I left with more heat than I had before the match. Mission accomplished all across the board. Afterward, I spoke to Vince about it, and he reiterated Pat's theory.
I wanted this finish because it helps you. When he won, it put the spotlight on you, not him. They might not even remember his name after this, but they'll remember the fact that you lost to a rookie and laugh at you for it. You'll get more heat as a result. Do you get that?
I did. And it was refreshing to know that even after 20 years on the job, there were still lessons to be learned. That's the way it should always be. Chapter 37, Nexus Knuckleheads. I got a call from Barry Bloom in May 2010 that ABC was looking for a host for their new primetime game show, Downfall. I was swamped working 5 days a week with the WWE, but I thought it would be a smart move to at least audition. I flew to L.A. and had a face-to-face meeting with the producers who explained the rules of the game and what was expected of me. Downfall was basically a quiz show with a unique twist in that all of the prizes were on a giant conveyor belt on the rooftop of a downtown L.A. skyscraper.
If you could answer the questions within a certain time, the belt would stop and you would keep the goods. But the longer you took to give an answer, the faster the belt moved, until the prizes tumbled over the edge of the building and crashed to the street hundreds of feet below. A little more complicated than, say, Deal or No Deal, but an interesting idea all the same. The producers seemed to like me and asked if I was interested in doing the show. I told them I was, but didn't really think it could happen due to my WWE schedule, and never thought about it again. I didn't bother telling Vince anything about the audition, as I didn't want him getting involved and complicating matters like he had in the past when it came to his talent working outside projects. Besides, he'd never had a problem with me doing other things before, and I figured if I actually got the job, I'd tell him then. A few days later, on a Friday, I got a call from the producers who asked if I could come in to audition again, this time for the ABC Top Brass. I'd made it to the final three, and they wanted to see me in person in Los Angeles before the following Tuesday when they would make their decision. Problem was, I had Next in Dallas that Tuesday, and couldn't miss it because it was the season finale, and the winner was going to be announced. I was convinced Barrett was going to win, so there was no way I could get out of Next. But I didn't want to miss the opportunity to host a primetime network TV game show. My chances of making it to Dallas for the show were slim, as there were no commercial flights that could get me in and out of L.A. on time. So I bit the bullet and arranged for a private jet to fly me Monday night after Raw in San Antonio to Los Angeles, and then back to Dallas the following Tuesday afternoon. It was going to cost me $15,000, but that was a small price to pay if I got the job. So after Raw, I flew into L.A., grabbed a few hours of sleep, and headed over to ABC in the early morning for my audition. I got a quick debriefing from the producers explaining what they wanted from me. I saw the names Ian Ziering and Mario Lopez written on a manifest on the wall and assumed they were my competition, and was taken to a vacant rooftop. Then, in front of some of the most powerful people in television, I mimed and improvised an imaginary episode of Downfall. My groundlings training was in full force that morning as I described the expensive prizes that only I could see plunging off the imaginary conveyor belt. When I was done, I got a smattering of applause and everyone told me how great I was. Typical Hollywood reaction. I thanked them and zipped back to the airport where my jet took off at 12:30 p.m. sharp. I landed in Dallas at 5 and weaved through rush hour traffic to the American Airlines Arena, arriving just in time to get ready for Next, which went live at 7 p.m. One of the writers asked where I'd been all day, and I said, "What do you mean? I've been here for hours hanging around in the stands." It was a good thing everything panned out travel-wise, because Barrett was announced as the winner, and the show ended with the two of us in the ring celebrating. I celebrated again a few days later when Barry told me I got the job as the host of Downfall, even though I still hadn't told Vince that I was even up for it. When ABC placed a press release in Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, trumpeting the show and its new host, I thought it was awesome. Until Barry called me in a panic. "Stephanie just contacted me and said you're not allowed to host Downfall." When Vince saw the press release, he flipped out and said under no circumstances are you to do the show. I was shocked. Obviously, I had dropped the ball by not telling Vince about the gig, but this was a perfect chance for the WWE to get the mainstream coverage they craved by having one of its top guys host a primetime major network program. Not to mention I delivered it to him on a silver platter with no expense or effort on his part. Why would he forbid me to do it? It made no sense, so I called him myself. "Chris, I can't allow you to do this show. It sets a bad precedent if I let talent go find opportunities on their own. Also, we have an agreement with NBC, and if you do an ABC show, our investors will be asking why you're not doing an NBC show." This was total bullshit, even though I knew I'd insulted him by not telling him I'd gotten the job in the first place. But it was always easier to ask for forgiveness than permission, right? "Look, Vince, I'm sorry for not telling you about this, but if you look at the big picture, this is good for all of us. I got picked for this job over 50 other people with celebrity value. If this show hits, it could be a big thing for the WWE and for me." Vince refused to budge and reiterated that there was no chance in hell he was going to let me do the show. That pissed me off.
Vince, this is bullshit. You're fucking with my future and you're fucking with my family. I'm doing this show whether you like it or not.
If you do it, I'll fire you on the spot.
I'll quit first. My contract is almost up anyway.
You are really stupid if you do this.
Now I really lost it. Stupid? All right. I'm going straight to the airport and chartering a plane to Connecticut so I can come over to your house and punch you in the face, I screamed into the phone.
I'll give you my address, he yelled back.
I hung up on him. I couldn't believe things had come down to this, but I really felt he was screwing up a big chance for me. I went through my contract to try to figure out if he could sue me for quitting the company. I was poring through the various sections and subsections when I heard the beep of an incoming email from Vince.
I hope you understand the reasons I can't let you do this. However, we're taping a film next month, and I want you to star in it.
Who the hell tapes a film in this day and age? I didn't understand Vince's logic in offering me the starring role in a straight-to-DVD movie that would take me 6 weeks to film and be seen by a few hundred thousand people, yet refused to allow me to host a primetime TV show that would take me a week to film and be seen by millions. I told him I wasn't interested in taping a film and asked him to rethink his decision. A few hours later, he called me again, and this time it was a different Vince on the line.
If you want something from me, then I'm going to want something from you, he said in a gruff Clint Eastwood voice. I'll let you do the show, but I want you to commit to a new contract.
We'd been going back and forth over the last few months about what I felt were some low payoffs, and I wanted some sort of restitution. I suggested stock options or a signing bonus for my next contract, and he was hesitant because he'd never done anything like that before. I refused to negotiate a new deal or come back to the WWE until he made things financially right. I reminded him I still wanted updated compensation for the past year. To his credit, Vince promised to go back through my payoffs to see what he could do. A few weeks later, I got a hefty six-figure check in the mail. Plus, he gave me his blessing to do Downfall. In return, I agreed to come back to the WWE for another run. Downfall only lasted 6 episodes and was panned by the critics, but they all agreed the one positive was my performance as host, and doing the show opened a lot of doors. It also opened another door between Vince and me, as I believe he respected the fact I didn't back down from him, even though he didn't agree with me at first. Conversely, I realized not keeping him in the loop and not telling him I was up for the job was the wrong thing to do. It was very disrespectful to him, and I'm sorry for that. But the whole situation brought us closer as business associates and friends. I've said many times that I believe Vince is a genius, and a perfect example is when he orchestrated the next invasion of Raw. He felt that since the next show had ended, the rookies would flounder without a specific role, so he decided to have all 7 of them unite and annihilate John Cena on Raw. It was an incredible scene watching this pack of no-names become big stars in 10 minutes by completely destroying Cena, the ring announcer, the timekeeper, and tearing apart and dismantling the ring for the first time ever on live TV. People had never seen anything like it before, and the crowd in Miami was furious when Barrett stood center ring and announced that the Nexus were taking over the WWE. It was mass chaos as they swarmed the superstars like a school of piranhas, using their vulgar displays of power to leave them laying time after time. The WWE fell on black days as the Nexus knuckleheads marched through the company with their vicious onslaught. But who could stop them? Who could end their radical reign of terror? Chris Jericho, that's who. To combat the evil invaders, Cena put together a group of freedom fighters that included R-Truth, Kali, John Morrison, and the returning Bret Hart. He approached Edge and me to help him even though we were bad guys, as Vince had pulled the plug on Edge's babyface run a few months earlier and turned him back heel. Cena approached us multiple times to join his team WWE and help him defend the honor of his beloved company, but we kept refusing. After all, why would the two most dastardly villains on the planet want to help John Cena? The stalemate came to a head on the last Raw before SummerSlam 2010 in Sacramento,
during a match between Cena and Bret Hart versus Edge and me, with the Nexus members stationed ringside as lumberjacks. Eventually, they jumped in the ring to beat down the good guys as Edge and I powdered out to avoid the mugging. Truth and Morrison hit the ring to even the odds, but were quickly overtaken by the numbers game. We continued watching Team Good Guy getting the shit kicked out of them as the crowd begged and pleaded for us to help. After teasing them by turning our backs, we eventually reconsidered and charged the ring to a massive roar. The two factions lined up like the Greasers versus the Sox, staring each other down, waiting for the other to make the first move. The crowd was losing their shit to the point that the hard camera filming the action was literally shaking. If you were watching Raw at home that night and saw the picture on your TV moving wildly back and forth, it's because the Sacramento fans were stomping their feet so hard it threw the tripod off balance. We decided that the Nexus guys would wait to take action until I gave the cue, as some of them were green and I didn't want anybody jumping the gun. I stalled as long as I could until the crowd reached their zenith and then threw the sign. We charged at each other, converging in a sports entertainment wall of death, throwing hands and feet like ninjas until eventually the baddies bailed to fight another day. Team WWE stood tall in the aftermath, working the crowd like the white meat baby faces that we were. I have to admit it was fun to be on the other side of the fence for the first time in years, and having the crowd chant Y2J again. It was amazing how much goodwill I'd built up with the audience over the last decade, and that I could be the biggest piece of shit for so long and yet with one act of valor be instantly back in their good graces. I think that's because you guys feel that no matter what, I always do my best to give you your money's worth. And I do. The angle culminated at SummerSlam in Los Angeles with a 7-on-7 elimination match between Team WWE and Team Nexus. But I wasn't sure if I'd even be able to participate because on the day of the show, I could barely walk. If I put pressure on my left foot in any way, it felt like I was getting stabbed in the bottom of my arches. I wondered if I had a fracture or a bone spur and texted Doc Amon to tell him I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to work the show. He told me it could be a bone spur or a torn tendon and he'd check it out when I got to the Staples Center. I have a reputation for never being hurt, and for me to even consider not working the main event of the PPV, I knew something was seriously wrong. I was scared as I limped into Doc's office in great pain, using my luggage as a crutch and gingerly climbing onto his table. I took off my shoes and socks and explained the agony I was in. I'm pretty sure it's a bone spur, Doc. Maybe a torn muscle. That's the worst pain ever. Okay. Doc said. I found the problem. How could he diagnose the problem that quickly? Was it so serious that he was able to figure it out instantly? That was not a good sign. This was awful. I was going to need surgery, and I was going to be out for... Doc held up the tiny splinter he'd removed from the bottom of my foot with a pair of tweezers in about 2 seconds. Never mind. My mortal injury healed, I went into Vince's office where the guys were putting together the match and where a returning Daniel Bryan had been hidden. He'd been fired after the initial Nexus invasion for choking ring announcer Justin Roberts, nice white teeth, with his own tie, but had been forgiven and rehired, and was now the secret seventh member of Team WWE. The match was going to come down to Justin Gabriel and Barrett versus a solitary Cena. John was insistent that Barrett pull back the mats and give him a DDT on the concrete floor as a false finish. After kicking out, he was going to pin Gabriel and then make Barrett tap out with his STF submission. Edge and I disagreed with John's logic and thought the DDT on the cement floor was unnecessary, especially since he was going to be winning by submission a short time later, which we also disagreed with. The Nexus was white hot at the time, and we thought it was way better to have Barrett win, but Vince wanted Cena going over, and that was that. But at the very least, we knew it would be better to save the cement floor DDT for another day, and have John barely squeak out the victory after being beaten down the whole match. John disagreed, and felt the DDT was the way to go, so we reluctantly agreed to do his finish.
The angle had been built up so well that the crowd was primed and into it from the start. Each elimination was met with the desired reaction, including mine, where I was pinned by Heath Slater for the second time, this time at my request, who then went on to pin Edge shortly after. To remind people that we weren't officially good guys, Edge and I then attacked Cena and put the boots to him after our ousting. Soon after, Barrett threw John to the floor, removed the padding, and DDT'd him on the concrete. The fans oohed accordingly, then popped when he kicked out, but not as big as they should have. It was almost as if they knew that kicking out after being dropped on your head on cement wasn't believable. They had been taken out of the fantasy world we'd created, the same way they would have if they'd seen a boom mic in the middle of the Battle of Helm's Deep in Lord of the Rings. John eventually won the match, but the reaction wasn't as good as it could have been after all the time we'd spent developing the storyline. Later in the dressing room, Cena approached me and admitted he'd made the wrong decision by doing the match his way. "Don't forget, John, as good as you are, Edge and I have been in this business for 40 years combined, so if we have an opinion about a finish, you should consider listening to us." John nodded his head in agreement, and then we shook hands, congratulating each other on a job well done. And I believe it was a job well done, as I really enjoyed the Nexus angle. As a matter of fact, when I combined it with the recent HBK and Mysterio angles, I felt I'd produced a pretty damn good body of work over the last 3 years. I used to tell people when I left the WWE in 2005 that if I didn't go back to wrestling, I'd have no regrets. But looking back, I realized that wasn't true. There was a lot more I wanted to prove and accomplish in my wrestling career at the time, and I felt I'd improved by leaps and bounds since then. Now, between the classic storylines and matches I'd been involved in during the last 3 years, and the additional 3 world title reigns, I finally felt I'd accomplished everything I wanted to do in pro wrestling. Now that my contract was nearing its end, I was planning on taking a few months off to tour with Fozzy and then come back to the WWE a few months later. But something came up that changed those plans. It was time for me to dance. Chapter 38, The Dancing Beast. The first time I was asked to do Dancing with the Stars was right before my WrestleMania 26 match against Edge. I was kind of surprised that they'd asked me, then found out that my old party buddy, Stacy Keebler, had mentioned my name to the producers and was pushing for me to get on the show. I wasn't too sure if I wanted to do it, but upon Stacy's insistence that it was one of the best experiences of her life, I figured it would be worth at least taking the meeting. In Hollywood, you don't have meetings, you take them. The producers insisted that I'd be great on the show and that they would do whatever it took to get me prepared, including flying my dance partner in to practice in whatever cities my shows were in. But I had never danced before in my life, and knowing how much work I already had each week with the WWE, as well as how crazy WrestleMania time was, there was no way I could handle the responsibility of learning a whole new craft. I respectfully declined, and the producers told me I was welcome on DWTS any time. I passed a second time after they asked me again while I was in Ireland on tour with Fozzy at the beginning of September 2010. It kind of pissed me off that they'd waited until the last minute to ask, as their season started in just a few weeks. It was like they thought I was just sitting around on the couch eating bonbons with nothing else going on. But I still wasn't convinced I wanted to be on the show, because if I was going to take on something as massive as DWTS, it would have to be my one and only priority. They'd have to give me more than 2 weeks' notice for me to get ready. They took my words to heart and called me back 10 days later to ask if I'd join the cast of the February 2011 season. They'd loved my personality and downfall. DWTS was on ABC as well, and thought I'd be perfect for the show, and wouldn't take no for an answer this time. I had to decide if I wanted to do this, for there were no more excuses why I couldn't make it work. I also felt that if I didn't accept their offer this time, they might never ask again, so I decided it was now or never. I had been reluctant before because I didn't know anything about the art of dancing, but after a quick chat with Stacy, she assured me I would do great and love the experience. so I made up my mind. It was time for Dancing is Jericho. I called Vince out of courtesy to tell him I wouldn't be back in the WWE in January as planned, because I didn't want another downfall situation.